I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Will now please cross to the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright. Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, it's the return of the Parallax Views double feature. First up, returning guest, Mickey Huff of the legendary media watchdog group Project Censored, joins us to discuss his new book, co-authored with Nolan Higdon, The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America. Project Censored is a diamond in the rough when it comes to media criticism, in that it avoids crude Trump-like attacks on the free press while also making nuanced structural critiques of media bias. Then, after hearing from Mickey Huff, we'll be joined by comedian and activist Sam Spadino, who made headlines last year after being arrested at a Trump rally for heckling the president over his association with wealthy sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. You may remember him as the man bun guy. From those Trump rallies, he made quite the wave. Hell, he even got the attention of Fox News for his troubles. But first up, my conversation with Mickey Huff of Project Censored on his new book, co-authored with Nolan Higdon, The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America. Welcome back to Parallax Views, Mickey Huff of Project Censored. You have a new book out, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. You're here to talk about the book, which you co-authored with Nolan Higdon, and there's a nice little foreword by Ralph Nader as well.
Yes, thanks so much for having me on the program. It's always good to talk to you.
Well, maybe for my listeners that didn't get to hear the last episode we did together, it was, you know, going on a year ago now, probably. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about Project Censored. I don't think it gets nearly enough attention. You guys have been doing good work for a long time.
Yeah, Project Censored was founded in 1976. I'm the third director. I just finished my 11th edited annual volume for Project Censored in the Censored series. Andy Lee Roth and I have been doing that for about a decade now. And what the project does is basically the news that doesn't make the news and analyzes why. We have a top 25 list of most censored underreported stories every year that makes the alt weeklies and gets sent around. Since 1993, we've done an annual book. And since 1995 or six, we've been with Seven Stories Press the independent publisher out of New York. And we explain all of our methodology. We have, over 20, close to 30 international judges that look over our work and our stories. We work with 20 different campuses, scores of faculty, and somewhere between 200 and 300 students every year researching this. So this project is not just us sitting around saying what we think is censored or underreported. It's a critical media literacy education project that's designed to teach people how to be news literate, independent, critical thinkers on their own. Our job isn't to tell people what the news is. It's to try to help them understand how to navigate and deconstruct the news by understanding things like the propaganda model and news bias and how to detect fake news and these kinds of things. And as you know, and of course, as your listeners likely know, this topic has gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of years, I guess for both good and bad reasons. But the silver lining for us is that a lot of people we think are starting to ask the right questions about media sources and about the problems of censorship, which are actually quite pervasive and even come in very insidious forms like alleged solutions to fight fake news.
Well, you know, it's interesting. This whole topic has been getting a lot of coverage lately. I mean, since 2016, we have all these attacks on the press by Donald Trump, and they're attacks that remind me of you know, I think I told you this off air, but they remind me of, you know, Nazis screaming Lügenpresse at Hitler rallies. And that's really bad. I'm very worried about that. But at the same time, we have people like Bernie Sanders who are accused of being exactly the same as Trump whenever he criticizes the press. It seems like there's no room for middle ground within the Overton window of discourse right now.
Well, it's really, it's again, the media, the corporate press in particular, loves the false equivalency. They love the pretense of objectivity manifest through both sides discussions, which are frankly just absurd on the face of them. Trump has weaponized that phrase. Of course, the Democrats and the Washington Post and some of the legacy media helped get it started with their whole infatuation with Russian involvement in the election. But Trump weaponized the phrase and turned it right back around on the media to use it as anything he disagrees with can be labeled as fake news. But I mean, this goes back even to when he was on the campaign trail. There literally were people in his audiences who were using the phrase Lügenpresse. I mean, which is just absolutely phenomenal in terms of what it means. Historically, it goes back to World War I and II. And, you know, it's basically the equivalent of saying that this is false news or fake news. I mean, it's pretty amazing that these people literally say these things and barely get called out for it. The United States has now been placed on one of the top five most dangerous places for journalists to be in the world. We've seen an unprecedented escalation against journalists, both corporate and otherwise. Time magazine went so far as to declare the beleaguered or targeted journalist person of the year this past year. But there's a huge difference that needs to be made. And that's that there is a long tradition of media criticism that goes way back to the early 20th century. And in fact, it had some may argue it had its muckraking heyday then, or was revised during the George Seldes period. And I would argue that we do have a pretty vibrant series or group of intrepid independent journalists that do a lot of quality work nowadays, but they get drowned out by the din, you know, the noise of corporate media and Twitter and social media. And the reason I want to make this significant differentiation, and you brought up Bernie Sanders, because this is something that's just gone on recently in the news cycles. Sanders finally took off the gloves and decided that he wasn't going to take it sitting down, because the Washington Post in particular and a lot of the rest of the corporate media, they've been targeting him when not ignoring him, right? Like in the election period, in the election cycle last time, 2016, when rather than covering Sanders' impressive win in some of the primaries, most of the legacy and corporate broadcast media, instead of covering Sanders' work, they cut to an empty podium of Donald Trump, just waiting with bated breath for him to show up for something, because it was like red meat to the lions. Sorry for the vegetarians and vegans in the audience for the metaphor, but nevertheless, you know, it just shows they have this bias for sensationalism. And the real problem is they won't cover the Sanders campaign because, as Shelley Stanley recently wrote at Counterpunch, let's call it what it is, the corporate media. It's owned by corporations, its interests are corporate, and its advertising sponsors and cross boards of directors. Its interest is not we the people. So any kind of possibly progressive or populist campaign of any kind that bothers to tap into the actual socially scientifically supported polling data about the overall political attitudes of the American public realize that a majority of the public on issues from election integrity to universal health care and affordable education and better jobs, the public skews to the left. Right. And look, I'm not saying Marxist left here, but the public skews liberal progressive on these issues. And that is actually where more of the mainstream exists in the United States on the basis of the actual data. However, the corporate media has long called itself the mainstream press so that it has this corporate coup d'etat, a propagandistic coup d'etat, where it gets to ride under the assumption of objectivity and through the objectivity bias of false equivalency, that it somehow has been anointed to talk about the both sides bogus narrative. Meanwhile, candidates like Sanders, people like Tulsi Gabbard on foreign policy to another degree, they go outside the corporate narrative. The corporate narrative on war is, yes, let's have some. The corporate narrative on Medicare is maybe we should privatize it. And even Kamala Harris is calling for that in the Democratic Party. So it's really important what's going on to notice, because in the primary with Sanders, the Washington Post ran 16 negative pieces in 16 hours online. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting out of New York has been fantastic about pointing out this bias. And now Norm Solomon, Jeff Cullen, associated once upon a time with FAIR, also Roots Nation, etc. They've begun calling it out. And now Bernie himself has begun calling it out, except when Sanders does it, he's playing a fake news game with Trump, except no, he's not. Project Censored has been fighting the fake news since 1976, and when we criticize the corporate press, we're not the same either. We don't say it's fake because it's flat out wrong. You know, we'll point to a Judith Miller on WMD bogus stories. As Matt Taibbi said, you know, the Russiagate story is this generation's WMD. We'll point to some of that bogus reporting of Rachel Maddow. But that's not at all the same as calling it out in a weaponized fashion as propaganda, like a demagogue, to smear the Fourth Estate so that it speaks as it's not even dog whistle at this point. It's virtue signaling to the far right that Trump isn't going to deal with this media. They're going to do an end run around it on Twitter, and his followers know where to distort and abide on their own, as we write about in United States of Distraction.
Well, I was going to add to that. I like how you've sort of laid that out there. You know, I think it's possible to criticize an outlet like the Washington Post without doing it in the Trump-like way. I mean, there's actually a few people that write for the Post that I like, mainly Liz Brunick, who's actually a Bernie supporter. But we can still criticize the Post as a whole and some of its corporate interests without saying, oh, everyone who writes for the Post is part of some conspiracy. There's a more nuanced critique we can make than what Trump is doing. And that's what I appreciate about your book and what you're doing with Project Censored.
Yeah, we've been trying to do that for a very long time and try to tell people, you know, because people often will say, well, where do you get your news? Like, people want some fix, some onestopshop.com. You know, truenews.com. I don't know. But people always are looking for the easy way out. And frankly, there's no easy way to think critically. There's no easy way to spend time trying to verify factual information. I mean, there are tried and true ways, but they all require time. They all require effort, and they require critical media literacy education. They require the support of critical pedagogy, and they require the legitimate space to criticize these legacy and corporate news outlets. The New York Times does some stellar reporting on occasion, and when they do, we laud them for it. We simply ask the rest of the time what their problem is. And we know what in part the problem is. It's the propaganda model of the conflicts of interest and the issues surrounding ownership, advertising, elite sourcing, flack, and ideological bias. We have since added many filters to the Ed Herman Noam Chomsky propaganda model from 30 years ago, where we talk about bots and algorithms and things like automated laser phishing, right? And as Aviv Avedian, a technologist, talks about deep fakes and talks about, you know, great manipulation of video in an infocalypse, as he's called it. So we are trying to cut through the noise with critical media literacy tools. And you can, you know, your listeners can go to projectcensored.org to learn more about us. They can learn more about our books there, our weekly radio show, an accompanying podcast that Nolan Higdon does. They can also check out our films. We're finishing a fake news documentary with Abby Martin of the Empire Files right now that'll be out in September. You know, there's plenty of places to go to find this kind of information. It's just often people don't know where to get it. And when we're out speaking to people, they always ask. They're like, where do you get information? And we said, it's all over the place. You just have to know how to critically approach the information, and you need to know how to ask the right questions about it so that you're less likely to be duped, right? And in fact, we have these skill sets and fact-checking tools on our website. Our sister site is gcml.org for the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, where we have an educator resource guide on critical media literacy pedagogy, and it's available for free at gcml.org. And again, you know, Nolan Higdon has just finished another manuscript on the anatomy of fake news, and we're actually teaching courses on fake news detection. He has something called a fake news detection kit, 10-point process to save our democracy. In other words, you know, there are things we as everyday people can do to not be duped by the maelstrom of disinformation that is digital media.
I was wondering, maybe we could get a little bit into the first chapter of your book, The Crumbling Fourth Estate. And also, before we do that, I want to ask you, why the title, United States of Distraction? What sort of inspired that?
Well, you know, we rolled around a few different titles with our editor, Greg Ruggiero at City Lights, who is fabulous, by the way. It's really an honor to have the Censored Books or Seven Stories Press out of New York, another fantastic independent publisher. City Lights, of course, is historic. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the beat poet, San Francisco, going back to the early 1950s. And we really wanted to frame the book in a way that doesn't come across as, oh, here's some left-wing academics pulling the usual business. Here's some progressive guys that don't like corporate media or, you know, right-wing media. But it really, you know, we started it out at the beginning with a fantastic epigraph from Lawrence Ferlinghetti himself, who just turned 100 years old. Our government is a bird with two right wings. They're devoted to the perpetuation and spread of corporate capitalism. Look, the current situation that we find ourselves in the United States can likely not any better be summed up than by that quote. And so what we wanted to do is we wanted to dive in and not just look at our current situation where there's so much noise in the social media environment and corporate media environment and broadcasting. And of course, the assault on print media that's been going on for the last few decades. We wanted to frame it historically as part of the program of corporate enclosure of the commons. And Ralph Nader was a fantastic choice for the foreword because Ralph has been, you know, screaming from the rooftops about this issue for half a century. And the first chapter on the Crumbling Fourth Estate ties into the United States of Distraction, sadly, quite well. And we start out our book in the prologue by basically saying, how did we get here? We didn't just end up here with fake news and Trump and people talking heads screaming back and forth and Russia everywhere and so on. We go back and look at the 2016 quote from then CEO of CBS, Les Moonves, who said at the Stanley Technology Media and Telecom Conference in San Francisco, he said about the primary coverage of the election, he said, sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. I've never seen anything like this, Moonves said, and this is going to be a very good year for us. That's a small U.S., not a big U.S. period for United States. It's an us for CBS and their shareholders. And this really encapsulates the United States of distraction and sensationalism, something that Chris Hedges was talking about years ago in Empire of Illusion, the triumph of the end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle, where he's riffing on Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death from 1985. And this is where we wanted to go, is we wanted to trace this back. Not only did we want to trace back the media criticism and scholarship that had predicted all of this over the decades, we wanted to go back to the enclosure movements of the 50s and 60s, whether it was James Buchanan, Milton Friedman, the Nixon administration, Spiro Agnew's attacks on the press, and the nattering nabobs of negativism. We wanted to show that there was an historical trajectory to this. And we had canaries in the media coal mine in the early 80s, like Ben Bigdikian, saying, we only have 50 corporations controlling the media. We're in big, big trouble. Oh, my God, we're down to about five. And so this is where we wanted to start. And we wanted to give people an historical backdrop to say, look, the people that have been paying attention to this, including journalists, told you that this was going to happen. This was predictable, but also, as Nolan and I argue in the book, not only did we think it was preventable, i.e., this wasn't the only way that we could have gone, but because we lack significant public protections and because we've had such corporate capture of regulatory agencies, lobbying in Congress, ownership of media, the influence of big pharma, big ag, the military-industrial complex, big tech, social media, Northwestern University and Princeton elite schools, even several years ago, even their elite political scientists who tend to skew more conservatively, said that the average U.S. citizen has zero impact on federal elections and that we live in a plutocracy. We do not live in a democratic republic. So, you know, the things that Nolan and I are arguing in the book, we claim aren't really even that radical. But the way in which we've been helped along to get the backslide into this, you know, morass of civil decay is because we are a United States of distraction. Through hyperpartisanship, a media-saturated landscape, through what we call public vulnerabilities, we have allowed ourselves to be distracted into a place to where we no longer can even seem to find meaningfully in our public discourse and civil society where we can go and what we can do about this, which is why the subtitle of our book is Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America and What We Can Do About It. And so we talk about how we got here in the several chapters. We offer far too many examples of this issue. And in the last chapter of the book, we call it Make America Think Again, where we tell people, like, this can be changed. We can do something about it. In fact, many people already are. That doesn't mean there are perfect solutions, but we need to get busy, and we need to get busy yesterday, or else we will be seeing a continuation of where we've been heading. As we start in the prologue with Lao Tzu, if you do not change direction, you may end up where you are heading. And our rhetorical question in the book, of course, is, are we there yet? So we encourage people to pick this up and really take a look at this. It's a great book for teaching, for sort of getting people to understand a brief history of how we got here. And specifically, I think, the way that we talk about the four public vulnerabilities and what we can do about them, both the crumbling fourth estate and the decay and corporate control and privatization of our education system are partially and a large part by that, is what I mean, to blame for how we got here.
Well, maybe if we could back up for a second for my younger listeners, you know, I think a lot of younger listeners, I don't think they may be familiar with the term fourth estate, which is unfortunate. And what's even more unfortunate is I don't think a lot of my younger listeners, especially millennials and Gen Z, I don't think they realize it was not always this way. I mean, if we go back to FDR, if we go back to the Fairness Doctrine, this was not the way things were in the past. There's been a slow creep towards corporatizing the media that has had a detrimental effect. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how things were different in the past and how there was sort of a muzzle put on this corporatization that was then taken off.
Yeah, the fourth estate, of course, is a term that refers usually to the press or to the news media. And it's referred to that as far as we have three branches of government, and the fourth estate is sort of another check and balance protected by the First Amendment Free Press Clause that is supposed to advocate for public interest, to hold people in power accountable for their actions, to help render more transparent government activity and what influences it. The term goes back, you know, into European history, but it's been commonly used in the U.S. through the 20th century. Actually, the term goes back to the 1700s. But for our practical purposes, it at least refers in a more generic way to how the media, the news media and journalists are a watchdog, purportedly. This is the theory. And look, if we go back in this country, in the United States, in terms of what the press was like in the founding period, the press was vigorously, conflict oriented. The papers were very partisan. They often were supported by political parties, which George Washington, by the way, warned against as the beginning of hyperpartisanship. But nevertheless, there were a lot of, a lot of negative reporting, mudslinging, that was very commonplace. But local municipalities had often several newspapers because they wanted to make sure, that whatever faction you were in, back in the day, Federalist, Anti-Federalist, slavery, anti-slavery, etc., you know, the people wanted to make sure that they were getting their views out there. So this whole notion of, quote, objectivity is a phenomenon of the 20th century and a phenomenon of the professionalization of journalism and academia and the rise of social sciences. And I'm not pretending that this is a horrible thing, right? I'm not saying that, oh, being objective is a horrible thing. Not at all. What I'm saying is that the way in which objectivity has been used as a cudgel to bludgeon its critics is that we're supposedly to assume that objectivity belongs to specific institutions like said fourth estate, but it's not to be questioned. So when you hear something in the New York Times, it's referred to as not only is their slogan all the news that fits the print. I like to say all the news that fits the print. They say all the news that's fit to print. Again, I think it's backwards, but they're called the paper of record. Right. And so they have a lot of these slogans that lend some kind of cultural credence to them, that they are uniquely objective and everybody else is biased and anything else is propaganda. Well, that's why I said that it was a great propagandistic coup for these media outlets to gradually assume the mantle of the mainstream media or the mainstream press. There's nothing mainstream about a half a dozen corporations that control allegedly public airwaves that are there to benefit their shareholders and advertisers for profit, for a bottom line. That's not mainstream. That's plutocratic. That's serving about 10 to 15% of the population. The bias against the Sanders campaign is just one in thousands of examples of how that works out. But yet when called on it, the New York Times editor was called on this not even a year ago, and said, well, we can't seem to find anybody that knows how to cover the Sanders campaign. You yourself mentioned somebody at the Washington Post earlier, so they've at least learned a little bit from that lesson. But look, they're not going to cede the territory of their mainstream title. That is very useful for them to maintain the objective label. And then so the problem with objectivity is objectivity, and this is something that's also referred to in media studies as the objectivity bias. There's this pretense that they're reporting from both sides. Well, you and I know that there are usually far more than two sides to a situation. But this is the easy way out for the press so that they can just stick somebody on the Republicans and somebody on the Democrats, hear a back and forth of either, don't have any follow-up questioning. You know, the political scientist Michael Parenti wrote for Project Censored in our 20th anniversary in 1996, nine media filters, not unlike the propaganda model that talked about how media play with the games of objectivity and false balancing, follow-up avoidance, and this kind of a problem. So this is what media critics, in our opinion at Project Censored, really need to address, is that it isn't that objectivity is a bad thing. It's a great principle. It's just that nobody really seems to be able to practice it very well. Least of all, often the people who claim to do it the most.
Well, yeah, and it's something that it's not just Project Censored that has pointed this out. I liked in your foreword by Ralph Nader, Ralph mentions that CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite, you know, over 40 years ago, he said that the 3 minutes or so devoted to a serious news story is merely a headline service. And that's a very bad development. I mean, even someone like Cronkite, who, you know, is one of the most respected mainstream anchors in news history. I mean, you talk to people that are a little bit older than my generation, you know, they still remember Walter Cronkite. Even he was sort of making these criticisms.
He absolutely was. And I'm glad you mentioned Walter Cronkite, because he and some of the other people, you know, around back in the day, like I.F. Stone, for example, you know, they were actually supporters of Project Censored, because we go back to 1976. In fact, Walter Cronkite himself, who was the anchor of CBS News until 1981, said that the project is one of the organizations that we should listen to be assured that our newspapers and our broadcasting outlets are practicing thorough and ethical journalism. I mean, Cronkite got it. I mean, you could argue that Cronkite was had his limitations and issues because of the platform. But let's not forget that in the 1960s, late 1960s, it was Walter Cronkite that called out the nonsense coming out of the Pentagon and the White House about what was happening in Vietnam. And it, after the Tet Offensive, it was Cronkite who blurted out on air, "Hey, what's going on here? I thought we were winning this war." And it really gave credence to the suspicion in the working and middle class, many of whose children were being whisked away to fight an immoral, illegal war that killed 3 million Vietnamese and almost 60,000 Americans, started under bogus pretenses that the media helped play up propagandistically in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And Cronkite, I believe, showed what very few journalists in the corporate media show today, and that's moral and ethical integrity. Something that you can see the Society for Professional Journalists call out, right, in their four main pillars of media ethics. And I urge your listeners to check them out. They're very important. But we now live in a media landscape of blogs and vlogs and podcasts, and where almost anything is rip and read. And unfortunately, we've gone from Cronkite's 3-minute headlines to 280 characters on Twitter, where the corporate media just wait like stenographers for some idiot whether it's somebody in the Democratic primary or Trump or one of Trump's minions or Bannon or Stephen Miller. They just wait for government by Twitter decree, and then they all dissect it and put 10 people on it and talk about a tweet for 10 hours on the news cycle, and then they wait for someone to tweet again. I mean, we have literally descended into an idiocracy that even Mike Judge said we had 500 years before we got to it, right? And yet here we are 10 years after his satirical film, Idiocracy. This was predicted, once again, I have to remind people, that if you go back to 1962, historian Daniel Boorstin predicted all of this in a book called The Image that we also write about in United States of Distraction. Daniel Boorstin wrote about what he called pseudo events in America. And he included in those things like press conferences, because they were canned. They were used to buttress this notion of two sides objectivity, and now we heard from both sides, and trusting the culture of expertise. It's the politicians and the experts and the smart people that we're interested in, not the common person. You know, and again, Boorstin, when he talked about this, 1962, just think about that. He said the rise of the image in combination with U.S. consumer culture would lead us to increasingly consume news that was based on nothing more than manufactured pseudo events. This is a prelude for today's post-truth and fake news disinformation crises. And this is what we write about in United States of Distraction. And I urge listeners to go back and actually read these books. Read Boorstin. And I go back further than that. In public talks, in our classes, we go all the way back to Edward Bernays and his 1928 classic Propaganda. That's literally the blueprint for how corporate media was created to be an instrument of the establishment. And rather than be a fourth estate watchdog of government, it's become a lapdog and catapult for propaganda.
Well, I was going to say, you can even go back further than that in some ways. You can see elements of scientific Taylorism in a lot of the way people approach education and media now. There's a lot of a sort of a push for technocratic sort of role.
Absolutely. And we write about that in the book, too. We've come a long way from John Dewey and critical pedagogy. And we talk about No Child Left Behind and the privatization of education and the teaching to the test. And this is basically designed to squeeze critical thought and analysis out of the curriculum. One of the biggest supporters and purveyors of No Child Left Behind in this movement was none other than Undersecretary of Education Diane Ravitch under George Bush Sr., who came out years later as the program's chief critic and admitted publicly that she and her cohorts were wildly wrong about the standardization of public education and advocated a massive reversal. The corporate people that took over education reform at that point basically pulled a Scanners on her, or an Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, like where they point at her in gaping jaws saying like, oh my God, you're some kind of invading monster. We've got to get rid of you. So they piled on her, attacked her character, pilloried her, and so on. What they never did effectively is refute any of her arguments. And that's what we also address in the book, is we're like, look, the chief architect of this privatization of education has admitted that it was not only deeply flawed, but it's helped dumb down and create a culture that is highly more susceptible to so-called fake news, mis- and disinformation, because we have a society of younger people that lack the ability to think critically about it. And that was further buttressed by the great Stanford study of 2015 and 16 that was based on this assumption that digital natives, millennials, were somehow less susceptible to digital manipulation via media. And what they quickly discovered is that was not true, that not only were they just as likely to be confused or unsure, it is now shown with further follow-up studies that younger people may even in fact be more susceptible to clickbait reporting online via social media.
Well, I was going to say too, like I said prior, it was not always this way. I mean, if we go back to 1934, there was a Communications Act that had a standard of public interest, convenience, and necessity when dealing with the news. We don't have that anymore. And it's amazing because, I don't think the digital natives, millennials, understand that there were safeguards against it, and they were all taken away, especially the rollback of the Fairness Doctrine, which sort of forced broadcasters to give equal time to different sides of an issue. That's all gone now.
Yeah, in the book, we talk about all of those issues. We talk about the 1934 Telecommunications Act, its only successor, the 1996 Telecommunication Act under the Clinton administration, which further allowed deregulation and more control and ownership. Fewer and fewer corporations to control the media. Reagan's rolling back of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987 that then led to the corporate capture of the corporate two parties controlling presidential debates, taking it away from the League of Women Voters to myopically control the agendas. We talked about right after the Fairness Doctrine how that led to the rise of massive right-wing radio with Rush Limbaugh and Clear Channel Communications, which is now iHeartMedia. Where 90% of the AM radio stations across the country were dominated with right-wing content. And it sowed great discord, riffing on Nixon's anti-press crusades of the 1970s, where they talked about how the press was essentially an enemy of the people. This is something that Trump has aptly resurrected to his benefit, to his use. It has been used by many others on the campaign trail, including Greg Gianforte, who in the special election in Montana, actually, when he was running for representative there and won, by the way, before the election, he actually slam dunked and body slammed a member of the Guardian of London newspaper, even was found guilty of it, and had to do community service and donate money to media organizations. But he was elected anyhow and was never subject to censure. This is absolutely preposterous. And as you'll see from the many blurbs in United States of Distraction, we're honored to have Robert McChesney on the cover. And this, the reason I'm bringing up McChesney is that if your listeners have not read Bob McChesney's work, it is absolutely essential reading for understanding the history of media in the United States. Rich Media, Poor Democracy, Communication Politics, and Dubious Times is arguably one of the most important of many books that he's written. If your listeners are unfamiliar with Victor Picard, I strongly recommend they pick up Picard's work. you know, there's people out there that have been talking about this important stuff for years. The history of this kind of media manipulation is important. I would argue that people should go back and read Herman and Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent. They should take a look at people like Alex Carey, the Australian social psychologist that was very influential on Herman and Chomsky. They should look at Bogdikian. They should look at Carl Jensen and Peter Phillips, the former directors and founders of Project Censored. You know, again, this isn't new. They should go back and deconstruct the Powell memo in the Nixon years that talked about how the right wing needed to control academia and needed to control the narratives in the media. Or they were going to continue to lose elections, which is why that precipitated increased gerrymandering, the rise of right-wing think tanks, and the gradual rightward shift of corporate media that was further continued by the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine and the 1996 Telecom Act.
Well, you know, there were just two more things I wanted to touch on briefly. The first was, you know, you can be critical of the mainstream media and even Democrats within the book. But you don't spare any, you don't spare anything for Donald Trump either. I was particularly, you know, unnerved by the story you told concerning Donald Trump and Justin Trudeau, you know, the Prime Minister of Canada, where Trump was accusing him of having a trade deficit with the U.S. And later on, Trump said, "No, I just made that up." He blatantly admitted to making that up. I mean, that's the world we live in now.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, again, not that we always agree with everything at the Bezos Washington Post, which has a long history with the CIA, and we've certainly written about that in our other censored books with Brian Covert and others.
Operation Mockingbird.
Yeah, that, and the Mighty Wurlitzer plays on, you know, Frank Wisner, et cetera. And listeners should definitely check that stuff out and look at that history, because that's a real serious deep state disinformation campaign that's been going on for decades. But as you just pointed out, Trump doesn't even hide the fact that he lies wildly and crazy. He just, you know, in the Trudeau example that you said, he literally just said, "Oh, I don't know. I just made that up." The Washington Post has been cataloging false statements made by Trump, and they're well over 10,000 in just 2.5 years of his presidency. I mean, just let that sink in for a minute. Over 10,000 demonstrably false, erroneous statements made by the president of the United States with near impunity. So this should show you the size of the crisis we are now facing, not just in journalism, but in our civic culture. We are decaying wildly and quickly as a republic, if we ever were, you know, going back to the Ben Franklin quip after the Constitutional Convention, right? You know, like, well, what do we have here? And he says, well, a republic, if you can keep it. I'm not sure we've been keeping it, but it is also important, I think, that you pointed out back in the 1930s, during the Roosevelt years, we had the rise of commercial radio. We had the protection of certain frequencies, so that we could have different stations, different views, competing ideas. You know, the four freedoms are really important too. Freedom of speech and expression, although the freedom from fear and want from the early 1940s that Roosevelt so importantly pointed out that the American people had rights to. Freedom of speech and expression. Well, inside of the freedom of speech and expression clearly is implied the importance of a vibrant, independent, free press. And in World War II, the press certainly wasn't free. It was vibrant and propagandistic, that's for sure, as were many other countries' medias, whether it was Germany's, Britain's, the Soviet Union's, etc. But after that, and the rise of the CIA and the rise of propaganda campaigns against communism, you know, that's where we started to see, you know, more troublesome type coverage in the so-called legacy media, which is why the work of people like George Seldes in that time, I.F. Stone, is really important. And I think that influenced the work of people like Walter Cronkite. And the further we seem to get away from those folks, the more and more in the corporate media we have seen basically stuffed suits. People like Brian Williams, I mean, who not only has been caught literally lying over and over again on air, after he loses jobs, he gets hired back. Chuck Todd over at Meet the Press basically admitted in an interview He said, I can't ask my guests the tough questions because they won't come back on. And then those guests, the elite sources, will go to other outlets and they'll scoop us and we won't get to cover them. So I can't. I mean, here's a multi-million dollar talking head broadcast journalist basically quoting the propaganda model as to why he can't report on the tough stories. So even for people who don't pay as deep of attention as we do on these kinds of topics, you know, you, I, some of your listeners, the people at Project Censored, et cetera, the many people we work with, anybody who even watches corporate media can see these people admitting to lying, admitting to being in shaping debates on sensational issues rather than substantive ones. Substance has been trumped by sensationalism, pun intended. And this is something that needs to be reversed and needs to be reversed immediately. But I don't think the corporate press has it in them. The profit motive is too strong. This is why we need a golden era, a revitalization and a renaissance of independent local press and media that we talk about in the last chapter, Make America Think Again, where we need to rebuild grassroots journalism and we need to go back to the principles and ethos of George Seldes, where the point of journalism isn't to be objective and detached, it's to tell the public what's really going on so we can participate meaningfully in our society.
Well, yeah, I would agree 110% with that. I mean, some of the things happening now that you catalog in the book, I didn't even know about. I didn't even know that Trump had been accusing Nancy Pelosi of being pro-human trafficking. I mean, that's a really bad situation when you have so much coming out of the Twitter storm and the internet and the media that you can't even keep track anymore. That sort of leads me to my last question. How do you tie in algorithms, big data, and what Shoshana Zuboff has called surveillance capitalism into the story of the United States of distraction?
Well, we do it in a couple places and in a couple different ways. And again, that's a fantastic book, by the way. If your listeners haven't checked that out, they should definitely check out Surveillance Capitalism. They should also check out, if they're interested more in some of the social media problems with algorithms and the rest, they should also check out Siva Vaidnathan's book, Anti-Social Media, about how Facebook has wrecked our democratic culture in general. There's another great piece published for free online by the Electronic Frontier Foundation and McSweeney's, the literary publication, called The End of Trust, that is a very, very important publication. And you can go to EFF.org and download that for free. I just taught a course last term at Cal State East Bay called Moral Economies of Digital Media and used those sources. And it was so eye-opening for the students to really see this. In the book, Nolan and I talk about an information war. And we talk about an organization called New Knowledge that had worked with Congress and the Senate Intel Committee and has been touted by the Washington Post as a really important, influential organization that fact checks and investigates Russian meddling in elections and so forth. But and there's a woman there, Renee DiResta, who does a lot of work and basically helped the Senate try to figure out how much Russia was involved. Now, there's a lot of problems with the Russiagate narrative. Nolan and I have a whole section in the book on the problems of how Russiagate is a huge distraction. And the corporate media fell for it hook, line and sinker as a way to sort of tar and feather the Trump administration. And then it fed right into Trump's war on the press to call it fake news. But DiResta has made some very solid points. The propaganda of Russiagate aside. And she said that we are involved in an information war. DiResta wrote a piece called The Digital Maginot Line, referring to France back in World Wars I and II, examining implications of living in an era of intense information manipulation. She calls it literally an information war. And she goes on to say, quote, in which state actors, terrorists, and ideological extremists leverage the social infrastructure underpinning everyday life to sow discord and erode shared reality. Now, this is true, but it's also the case that it's not just Russia that's doing this. It's the corporate media. It's big tech, big ag. It's inside Google that algorithms are written to spike certain views and spike certain people. It's Facebook and Twitter that have deplatformed certain people with little fanfare who were unpopular by most in the public, that were used as trial balloons to continue censoring over 1,000 other sites on Facebook. and Twitter. So that's actually part of the information war. And, you know, you go all the way back to Bernays to realize that this is by design. This is an elite process of winnowing out the bait so that these people can decide what are the actual narratives, what are the actual things we should be debating, and what things should be left on the cutting room floor. So the problem I have with people like DiResta isn't that she's wrong. It's that she only applies it in a certain direction. And let me be more specific about what I mean in that regard with her organization, New Knowledge. One of the co-partners at New Knowledge is a person named Jonathan Morgan. And during the 16 campaign, of course, we remember, hearing about, you know, the fake news mantra and Russia and how Russia's involved in this kind of stuff. What we didn't hear in 2017, however, as a follow-up, is that Jonathan Morgan of New Knowledge actively worked on his own behalf to try to manipulate the outcome of the Alabama special Senate election with Doug Jones and the controversial judge Republican Roy Moore, where he created, New Knowledge is a small cyber security firm. And what he did, and the New York Times even called this out as a false flag campaign. Jonathan Morgan made it appear as though Russia was interfering in the election on behalf of Roy Moore. He inserted bots and used this to try to unwittingly deceive voters in Alabama as what he called a test. He called it a test of the system. I mean, again, this is an amazing admission here that this happened. He said, quote, "We orchestrated an elaborate false flag operation that planted the idea that the Moore campaign was amplified on social media by a Russian botnet." I mean, this is amazing. This, and we write in the book, this execution of such disinformation operations in U.S. domestic political affairs should be of profound concern to anyone who cares about the integrity and information of our election systems. This is not just about Russia. This is about the people that are manipulating these elections behind the scenes, behind the curtain, to this very day. And they are right under our noses here at home. They are not in Moscow working for the Kremlin.
Well, I guess in closing, the way I sort of see things right now is we have, on one hand, these calls for a right-wing strongman by a lot of conservatives. And on the other, we have, you know, people that are just calling for what more or less to me is just technocratic rule. I think there's a lot of people that claim to like democracy that are actually pushing against it. I've seen a lot of disdain for, the people. And, you know, this idea that, oh, only experts and elites should be able to decide things. How do you think we can, you know, sort of approach both sides and go against them while pushing for more democracy? Because I think that's what we need right now, is a revitalization of the value of democracy, which is, you know, once that value goes out the window, it's game over, in my view.
These are inextricably tied. This principle of democracy and its success inextricably tied to a robust, open public education with academic freedom protections and a vibrant, independent free press. And this is what we argue in United States of Distraction. Nolan Higdon and I have long talked about the problems of techno-utopianism. Technopoly is something that the great scholar Neil Postman warned us about decades ago. And yes, you're right. Rather than call this American liberalism, what we now see in more is the corporate control of this ideology under what is called neoliberalism. And we write a lot about that problem in the book, because you're right. Neoliberals have a disdain for the public, a disdain for democratic institutions, a disdain in some ways even for academic freedom, when it means that these people are being criticized themselves.
They're right wing.
Yeah. The whole ideological spectrum has shifted right since the time of James Buchanan, Milton Friedman, back in the day when Grover Norquist said in the Nixon years they wanted to shrink the size of government down to the size where it could be drowned in a bathtub. I mean, this assault has been victorious. They have not only shrunk government, but they've captured it for corporate rule in the military-industrial big tech complex. And we unravel that web in the book, and we offer resources for readers. We offer several organizations that have been fighting this. We offer at least 30 to 40 different publications organizations, things that people can do. And again, we tie this in the end with a chapter called Make America Think Again. And that means we need a critical thinking curriculum and a critical media. As the great critical pedagogy scholar Henry Giroux writes, in the end, there is no democracy without informed citizens. What we have now are misinformed, disinformed, underinformed, ill-informed. We rarely have the deeply, accurately, factually informed citizen showing up at the voting polls to say, no more smoke and mirrors, no more man behind the curtain. And this starts at the local level. And this is why we encourage people, as much as we have our own anarcho-syndicalist tendencies, we encourage people to participate. You have to be an agent in getting information and sharing it with people in your own communities and where you live in communities where there is open oppression. If we are among any privileged groups in society, and I'm a white male that's a college professor and author and radio host, so I count myself demographically as someone that has been afforded privilege. I don't speak for other people, and I don't give voice to other marginalized people, but I have to acknowledge not only what they say and how they exist, I have an obligation to invite all of those people into any of the privileged platforms that I have been able to access in my lifetime so that they can tell their stories and they can be heard to create a serious, legitimate sense of equity in our culture. If we are to move forward and to have a vibrant democratic culture, like so many in our society allegedly clamor and claim they want.
Well, Mickey, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Maybe you could tell my listeners how they can get a hold of your new book, United States of Distraction. I know you have the next edition of the Project Censored Year in Review coming out in October. And maybe you can also tell my listeners how they can follow your work and the work of Project Censored.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's great to have a really informed conversation. And you certainly are among the better informed people that we've talked to about these issues. So I really enjoy going deep into the material, and I have a lot of respect for you taking a lot of time that you do on these issues to actually look at this stuff and have an informed conversation. ProjectCensored.org is the website. You can get our books there, listen to our radio show there, the Project Censored Show, now in its ninth year on about 50 stations, airing out of KPFA Free Speech Radio Berkeley in California. We're stationed in Northern California. Nolan Higdon's Along the Line podcast with Nick Baham III is also available on our website. You can get the United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation, and Post-Truth America and What We Can Do About It at ProjectCensored.org. Or at citylights.com. You can get Censored 2020 in October through The Looking Glass with Andy Lee Roth. That comes out in October. ProjectCensored.org or sevenstoriespress.com. Sevenstories.com is where you can get that. You can reach us online on social media at Project Censored, Mickey Huff on Twitter and Facebook. So we're available and we're around, and we love to hear feedback from people and love to hear ideas of who we should have on our shows. We're also going to be doing extensive book tours. So if you want us to come to your college, come to your town, please contact us. We'll be doing all kinds of talks coming up this fall across the country. So thanks again for having us on your fantastic program.
Eyes in the sky, gazing far into the night. I raise my hand to the fire, but it's no use, 'cause you can't stop it from shining through. It's true, baby, let the light shine through. If you believe it's true, baby, won't you let the light shine through for you.
That's right, let the light shine through, and that's exactly what activist and comedian Sam Spadino intends to do. You may remember him as the Man Bun Guy
that was arrested at a Trump rally last year after heckling the commander-in-chief with a photo of him and Jeffrey Epstein chumming it up. In the following conversation, Sam tells us about his experiences at two different Trump rallies attempting to shed light on the relationship between Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein. Additionally, we delve into the power of comedy and prankster-esque humor when politically applied, how Sam developed his anti-authoritarian tendencies, and how he became a full-time medical test subject, or what's been called a human guinea pig. In other words, it's a fascinating conversation with comedian and activist Sam Spadino, better known as the Man Bun Guy, Trump protester. But before we get to the conversation, why don't we cue up a clip of Donald Trump mocking and taunting good old Sam. Seems like Spadino got under his skin.
Get him out of here. Get him out of here. Go home to your mom, darling. Go home. Get him out of here. Out. Was that a man or a woman? Because he needs a haircut more than I do. Sure. Couldn't tell. I couldn't tell. Needs a haircut.
Welcome to Parallax Views. The man, the myth, the legend. He's a human guinea pig. He's the man bun guy that protested Trump. He's a comedian, an activist, Sam Spadino.
Hey, thanks for having me. How you doing?
Pretty good. I wanted to have you on mainly because Jeffrey Epstein is back in the news, but you sort of made headlines because of Jeffrey Epstein last year because of an incident at a Trump rally where you... held up a photo of Epstein with Donald Trump, and you know, that apparently made the Donald pretty angry, and he sort of made fun of you for having a man bun. Apparently got kicked out and all kinds of crazy stuff happened. Maybe you could tell us about how you caught headlines last year.
Yeah, well, I decided to go visit our president Donald Trump up in Duluth, Minnesota. He was having a rally last June, and the Epstein stuff had kind of been seared into my brain during the 2016 election. I knew that that was a wedge issue between both of the major candidates, and so since Trump became president, I wanted him to have to answer for what had happened, especially with, you know, Alex Acosta being in his cabinet, and his long-standing relationship with Epstein. Went to the rally, snuck in a photo of the two of them, got a right up in the first four rows, I would say, of the rally, pulled it out. He looked right at us, locked eyes with me. My friend was yelling child rapist pretty loudly, and we were able to kind of disrupt the rally for a few minutes, and Fox News happened to be carrying it live, so they zoomed right in on the sign repeatedly and actually captured it fully clearly, so someone on Twitter was able to pick out that this is a photo of Trump and Epstein. It said, "Who is Jeffrey Epstein?" on the sign. And all I knew was we were getting escorted out of the rally. Didn't know what impact it was going to have whatsoever, because before I got kicked out, I hadn't heard Trump respond. So I didn't know if it was going to go anywhere, you know, if the cameras picked it up. But once I got outside, check Twitter, and because he insulted my long hair, he said, was that a man or a woman? Because he needs a haircut more than I do. And if he hadn't said that, I don't think the story would have gone anywhere. I really don't.
You got under his skin a little bit there.
Yeah, I think if there's any chance he heard what my friend was yelling, child rapist, or if he saw the sign and knew what it was, I mean, his face really changes. He like freezes for about 2 minutes. It's a wild video to watch, because normally he's never thrown off for that long. And yeah, it did have an impact, because a bunch of news articles started popping up after that. And mind you, this protest happened before the big story in the Miami Herald broke. But fortunately, a number of articles did get spun out of this protest, including Fox News directly like profiling me, basically doxing me to all of their rabid fan base. They dug into, you know, my social media and certain articles that had been written about me, things in my past, and made it the front page on their website.
So you're at this Trump rally. How did the guards end up coming about and sort of grabbing you? And if you don't mind going into that, I know I liked what you yelled at the protest. You yelled, "Dad, Dad," and I thought that was actually pretty funny.
It was. I'll make it clear to your listeners, that was the second Trump rally that I've gone to. That happened in October, where I was planning a similar Epstein-related protest. And that situation, I had gone incognito and had been singled out somehow of the crowd by security. And so they started to remove me, and I was alone at this point. And so didn't get to hold up my sign, but I just started yelling, "Dad." And that led to me getting arrested. And that story got into the newspaper as well. So it sort of, you know, triggered back to the first one, where I didn't yell the ad, I just held up the picture. And then no arrest happened that time. But these articles, you know, came out. But yeah, when you're in the rally itself, it's very nerve-wracking. Like, you feel like you're infiltrating potentially dangerous territory. Thankfully, Minnesotans are relatively more relaxed, but you never know who's going to take a swing at you for simply holding up a photo. So a lot of tension kind of running through you. Luckily, I had a friend with me the first time, and then the second time I went by myself, so learned the lesson there.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I don't know if you're a fan of Hunter S. Thompson, but I always like the reporting Hunter S. Thompson did on the Republican National Convention, where Barry Goldwater was announcing his run for presidency and whatnot, and Hunter S. Thompson was like, when Barry Goldwater came out, he saw all these people like shaking and convulsing, you know, in like this sense of rapture that their, you know, savior figure Goldwater was coming out, and he talks about how he was so freaked out about it, because he's like, "I really hate this Goldwater guy," and I'm like, in this territory where they're all having a religious experience over him speaking.
Oh, it's exactly like that, because, you know, when you're in there, you're trying to blend in, but there's nothing that I like about Trump. So it's, you know, just trying not to respond to any of the people around me who are making some of the worst comments you've ever heard. Heard people in line kind of talking about genocide and the homeless. And,
oh, really? That's, you know, horrible.
Yes. I mean, the kind of things that just you overhear. And this was the second rally was around the time of Brett Kavanaugh. And so people were joking about that in line. And it's, you know, it's just this dark energy. I even recognized somebody in line for the second rally. And, you know, I felt like if they had seen me, they would have outed me, you know, like, guards, get rid of this guy. So I had to hide from, you know, an acquaintance in the line, because, you know, they probably would have thought I was an enemy combatant. And then, you know, later, when I do finally get kicked out, somehow, you know, somebody must have suspected I was, you know, not one of them. Still don't know the backstory on that. And, you know, the crazy part of that is when I'm yelling dad, you know, that causes a disruption, but I didn't think that was going to be enough to get me arrested. But nonetheless, you know, go to jail. I think I'm going to be released that night. Little do I know is that someone else has told the Secret Service a complete lie about me, that I said something other than dad that amounted to a threat, which did not happen. And there's, you know, body camera footage that didn't go anywhere, but it kept me jammed up in jail overnight, and I had to get kind of a wake up early and talk to the Secret Service, who had gone through my social media and were trying to infer that I had made a threat. So fortunately, that didn't go anywhere other than a second meeting with different Secret Service agents, just to make sure that nothing, you know, was wrong. But, you know, that's just, I mean, that is a weird outcome for yelling dad at Donald Trump.
Well, I was going to say, is it true that the rallies are a lot like, I've heard people describe it like it's almost like a wrestling event or a concert. Like when Trump walks out, it gets really crazy with how his, you know, fan club acts and whatnot.
Oh, absolutely. There's a whole arc to the rally, and having gone to two of them now and watched several of them, there's this build up with just the worst, like, I mean, they're fine songs, but the combination of songs that they play before the rally is like a bad wedding mix. You know, we're talking The Village People, Elton John, just this bizarre mix of like oldies. But then there's also these voiceovers that come out and tell you how to deal with protesters. So, you know, that's comforting. They have a voiceover that says, if you see a protester, just yell Trump, Trump, Trump around them until security shows up. And then there's, you know, little infomercials about how they make the red hats, and everybody's getting psyched up, and then Trump comes out, and yeah, they know the places to cheer when it, you know, goes to the media. They talk about fake news. Honestly, this season of rallies, I want to see, you know, just what is possible within a Trump rally, because it almost seems like they would chant just about any three words if enough people got it going. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's really weird. I know you said the Trump Epstein thing is like a wedge issue, but like there's times where I feel like some of these Trump supporters are so cult-like that like Trump could like sacrifice a human baby in a satanic ritual on stage and they would still end up supporting him for some reason.
And we might find out. And that, you know, to me that was like the line in the sand, where if you're, you know, if you're gonna question you know, Clinton on issues, that's good, but for me the relationship with Epstein and Bill Clinton, that's a line in the sand. You know, I'm not gonna support that kind of person. And same goes for Trump. And I would hope that there are certain people who are open-minded enough, you know, because the people who go to the rally are a different group than the larger, I would say, Trump supporting base. You know, they might eat from the same table, so to speak, but you know, they're not all as drunk on the Kool-Aid as the rest of them. So I'm hoping that as the Epstein sex scandal kind of continues, and I hope it does, Trump can get further enmeshed in that, because look what happened when the news started to break. He immediately pivoted into this crazy racist behavior to distract from Epstein, because that was the only thing that the media was talking about. So in order to get them off of that, he decided, I'm just going to be straight up racist, and that'll get them talking about something else. Like, that's how bad his relationship with Epstein makes him look. And if that's what he's willing to do, you know, and now who knows what else he's willing to do since they've started the cover-up process already. But I think there are some people who will be able to see through that.
Well, I was going to say, you know, just the whole thing, you know, where Trump Jr. came out and is like, Twitter is messing with the algorithms because of this hashtag Trump's body count in light of Epstein's death. And, you know, Clinton's body count, hashtag Clinton's body count is more popular. I'm just thinking to myself, these people are really, like, kind of insane.
Totally. Like, if that's the best, you know, argument you have is that you spent more time with the pedophile than I did. You know, I didn't really like him. No, that's ridiculous. The fact that Trump even kind of brought this up, he brought it on himself, because back before Pizzagate got started, Trump was with Sean Hannity at CPAC, and he's getting asked these rapid fire questions by Hannity. He says, what do you think of Bill Clinton? It's like, Trump says, nice guy, but he's got a lot of problems coming up with the famous island and Jeffrey Epstein. He said that out loud. There's no reason for that other than to maybe, you know, secretly tell the Clintons, hey, I'm willing to go here if you guys attack me on anything, you know. So, I mean, that's the only reason I could see him bringing that up. But he obviously knew, you know, Epstein was a bad guy before he was elected president. And yet he still brought Alex Acosta in. And, you know, and he still doesn't have a good response to why that relationship ended, if at all it did.
Yeah, his response was actually a little bit weird to me when he was asked about Epstein. He was like, well, we had a falling out years ago. We had a falling out. I can tell you, I don't like the guy. Don't like the guy. Don't like the guy. I'm thinking to myself, you know, if someone crosses Trump in the wrong way, he will immediately go after them. He doesn't wait to go after people. He's like a rabid dog. You know, he just goes right at him. So I kind of like wonder, like.
Exactly. He calls him a loser. He comes up with any sort of like insult. So if they really had such a falling out, and he knows what a terrible person he is, he knows the crimes that he's pled guilty to and is now alleged to have done, and the best he can come up with is I didn't respect him. Like, he said nicer things about, you know, murderers and worse things about, you know, nice people than he said about the most notorious pedophile.
I always thought it was funny. Do you remember that documentary? I think it was an HBO documentary, The Jinx, about Robert Durst.
I may have seen it.
Robert Durst was this guy who, there's like three murder cases that he got away from. His wife disappeared mysteriously, and then years later, he ends up in another murder case, and he's from the famous Durst real estate family. But he's sort of the black sheep of the family. But it was funny because Trump has actually defended Robert Durst since he hates the Durst family since they compete with him in real estate in New York. So he's actually said, I sort of understand where Robert is coming from about his family. I don't like his brother very much. And I'm thinking, like, this is the type of guy Trump is.
It's wild. He still probably to this day would defend Paul Manafort, who is in jail serving a 7-year sentence. Basically a slap on the wrist, but you know, he still thinks that he was given an unfair treatment because he knows that's the kind of treatment that is going to await him unless something really, really crazy happens again. So, I mean, hopefully that is something that the public can continue to tap into because, you know, when Trump is confronted, he doesn't like it and he slips up, you know, and he reveals his true nature, I think. And someone that volatile is, you know, scary, but it's also, you know, if the media is going to accept his response, I wasn't a fan, and just let it go at that. Okay, well, why did you party with him? Why do we have this video? Why did you have 28 girls at the Mar-a-Lago and just a private party for you and Epstein? Where are those questions? Like, that's, you know, why I feel like I need to do what I do to keep this story going. And thankfully, there's more journalists who are on board now, but it took, you know, over a decade to even question the crimes that happened in the first place.
Well, I was going to ask two things in that regard. The first is, how did you first become aware of the Trump-Epstein connection?
You know, I mean, it very well could have been from Trump. I feel like I was doing a lot of research into both candidates back then. And, you know, kind of obsessing about both sides because I was a Bernie Sanders supporter. So I looked at dirt on both sides as much, you know, and I think that the Epstein stuff kind of got kicked up in the mix of both parties kind of coming at each other. And then there was maybe a couple articles that popped up. There was the rape lawsuit that was filed as well. And there was a few articles about that. And so because people were attacking Bill Clinton with the Epstein stuff on the right, I tapped into that. And then I saw how it connected to Trump because, you know, I'm not supporting either of them. So obviously I want them both to fail. And so that's why Epstein kind of piqued my interest to begin with. And to be honest, I did think about doing a similar type of protest with Hillary Clinton. I reconsidered that. You know, I'm not crazy. I know that she's not her husband, but the fact that, you know, he's going to be getting back into the White House was a big concern to me. So it crossed my mind.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that lawsuit. I guess it was the Jane Doe, Katie Johnson case. And a lot of people have sort of thrown water on it because I guess there was an ex-Jerry Springer producer involved and all this other stuff. But I always have pointed towards the fact that, you know, Lisa Bloom was one of the attorneys involved with it. And Lisa Bloom is like an extremely respected, real deal civil rights and women's rights attorney. So to me, I think there may be more to that than a lot of people want to admit. I mean, I could be wrong, though. I don't know.
I mean, I tended to think so, too. And there's a video out there that's supposedly like a recorded deposition, and I believe that's supposed to be Katie Johnson in the video. Are you familiar with that Vimeo video that's out there?
Yes, okay. Yeah.
Has anybody disputed that that's the person that is the same person in the lawsuit? Do you think that, I mean, and so let's say that that's legitimate, you know, people should watch it for themselves and see, you know, is this a made up story? Because if, yeah, you're right. If a high profile lawyer is willing to take that, and Lisa Bloom is still engaged in the Epstein stuff, she's got other clients and she very may well be still representing Katie. I think that there's value to prying into that. And I think the fact that now Ed Opperman has kind of let on that he was involved a little bit more with that case from the beginning. It's very interesting. So we don't know where the, you know, the truth is gonna lead us, but I think that's worth pursuing, and hopefully more of these victims do come out.
Well, it also, people get confused sometimes. It wasn't a case that was thrown out. I mean, I think Katie Johnson herself, she alleged it was death threats, dropped the case.
Right.
And I think people confuse that. They don't realize it wasn't that the case was thrown out at all.
Yeah, I think it's very possible that she might have gotten some compensation. A lot of the victims did. Settle cases. And when that happens, you usually sign an NDA and, you know, you take the money and it goes away. And I bet you there's plenty of people who took the money and are now kind of in a tricky spot legally. But now that he's dead, I don't know if that changes things, but I know it's not going away. You know, more and more victims have come forward. So, yeah, I think if there's anything we've seen over, you know, the Trump years so far, dealing with when it comes to lawyers and the legal system, is, you know, hopefully Lisa Bloom is legit. You know, hopefully the lawyers who are fighting for these victims are doing the right thing. But then you look at some of the other cases that have involved Trump with Stormy Daniels, and her lawyer initially was doing backdoor communication with Michael Cohen. So that's
You mean Avenatti, right?
No, before Avenatti, it was Keith Davidson.
Oh, right.
Avenatti came in and replaced Keith Davidson, who had also represented Karen McDougal, and he was connected to the National Enquirer. So it's, you know, it's a sticky situation when you've got lawyers who are playing for both sides, and that concerns me a little bit too, because I know that there was legal representation. I think of the victims, one of the victims from the lawyer who's also connected to the Harvey Weinstein case. So, you know, there's a lot of loose ends that hopefully we keep trying to tie up.
Yeah, I think when it gets into legal cases, you get a mix of very credible people, like Lisa Bloom and her mother. I'm blanking on her name. I think it's Gloria Allred.
Allred.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and then you also get some really shady out there characters. I mean, even the reason I mentioned Avenatti is I know Avenatti can be a little bit out there with the cases he takes as well. So it gets really, it's a mix of people that are credible, people that are kind of shady. I mean, it could be a mess at times.
Absolutely. And strangely enough, Avenatti claimed that he was representing some Epstein victims. So I'm very curious to see where that's going to go, because, you know, he's got his own issues. I've definitely followed him because he's a ridiculous character, but, you know, he's still taking people down like R. Kelly. You know, like his stuff is still happening. So if he's connected to Epstein victims and he wants revenge on Trump, like, that could get very interesting.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you about what was the arrest technically for? I mean, you yelled "Dad." What could they possibly have to arrest you for? I don't understand that.
Yeah, I yelled "Dad." It took him about 30 seconds, maybe less, to get me out of the rally. Yelled "Dad" maybe 10 times, really loudly, but I wasn't, you know, fighting or brawling.
So you weren't resisting or anything?
No, there's body camera video. I'm getting dragged away by a couple of cops and a couple of security guards. You know, wasn't trying to push or anything like that. But the charges were disorderly conduct, disorderly fighting and brawling, trespassing, and obstruction of police work or something like that. And it seemed like trespassing was the first one that came to their minds, and then these other ones kind of kept getting added on.
Are they implying that you got in illegally or something? I don't...
The trespassing one confused me, and I even asked them when I was in handcuffs, you know, I didn't trespass. I had a ticket to this. It's free, you know. And they just implied that I hadn't left when they asked me to leave, which obviously I did, you know. So those charges all were dropped and had a lawyer have to deal with them and didn't even have to go back to court, fortunately, because that was down in Rochester, Minnesota. It got kind of handled over emails because I think they realized how ridiculous the case was. And, you know, there was body camera footage of the entire incident. So hopefully I'll be able to talk about that more. I've never released the body cam footage, so I think I'll try to strategically do that to bring attention to this case again.
What were the guards like? I'm just curious. I don't know if you want to talk about it that much, but
No, it's fine. The jail process was fine. I think they, you know, didn't necessarily know what was going on with me. They thought I was going to get let out, and then they felt bad when it turned out I had to remain in lockup overnight, and then went through the usual, like, strip search, change into prison garb, and go to the cell. There was a cellmate, you know. So it was kind of a bizarre thing. I'd never spent a night in jail before. And it really affected me in a way that I'm like, maybe did I do something wrong? Did I say something that I don't remember? And so, yeah, then I got woke up at 5 a.m. the next morning to chat with the Secret Service. So, yeah, I think they decided there was nothing to pursue either. And I hope that that means I'm off their books. But who knows, you know, if I'm still on a list somewhere or what.
I meant more like at the rally itself, the people who, you know, I guess the guy grabbed your arm and is like, let's go. It wasn't like something out of like that one incident with John Kerry where the guy yelled you know, something about skull and bones, and they tased him, and he says, don't tase me, bro. It wasn't like on that level of drama, right?
No, not too bad. The first one, they were, you know, pretty hands off and just sort of escorted us out. The second one, you know, because I hadn't even done anything and some security guard came up and started grabbing me, that's when I kind of reacted and just started yelling dad. But, you know, I didn't get tackled. But once I was outside of that second rally, shoved up against the wall, handcuffed, they sort of kicked my legs a little bit. But, you know, that was just the local cops. And Secret Service doesn't usually get involved. So it was some sort of private, you know, event staff that initially spotted me. And that still remains to be seen why.
Well, I mean, it doesn't sound like you're willing to sensationalize it at all. You're not looking to get attention for yourself on it. So I think that says a lot about you.
I mean, I just want the message to get out there. I would love more people to repeat this type of action. You know, it's very easy to get into a Trump rally since it's free, since it's you know, open to the public. This is our president. He doesn't own America, so anyone can go to these rallies. And so far I have seen one other person who brought in a Jeffrey Epstein sign, and you know, he got taken out of the rally too. He wasn't as close, and but, you know, that gives me hope that more people will kind of start to do that, because just letting somebody go off and tell lies to the nation for an hour without anyone challenging him, like, that just doesn't work for me.
Yeah, some of the stuff he says is just so out there. I was just talking to Mickey Huff of Project Censored. He has a new book out he co-authored called United States of Distraction, and he's listing some of the stuff Trump has said. You know, stuff like stuff that I didn't even know about because I can't keep up with the 24-hour news cycle. But, you know, Trump has, like, accused Nancy Pelosi of being pro-human trafficking. He went to Justin Trudeau and said, you have a trade deficit with us. And Trudeau said, no, we don't. Canada doesn't have a trade deficit with you. And Trump admitted later, he's like, yeah, I was wrong about that. I just made it up. He actually just admitted that he just made this stuff up. And yet he's the one yelling fake news. And it's wild.
Yeah, it really is wild. And it's comedy too, because like so much of what he says is just, you know, so unbelievable, but then so much of what he does is use that outlandish behavior to hide, you know, the stuff going on behind the scenes. And he has very effectively done that. And I think the best way to combat that is with outlandish, ridiculous behavior as well. So that's why I'm hoping that more, like, you know, it's one thing to tweet at back at the president, you know, plenty of people, celebrities are willing to do that. But I'm curious to see how, if more comedians will start to just engage with this, because I mean, it's Donald Trump, you know, it's an easy mark and he will respond to you, you know, and that, you know, can just change the entire narrative. You know, when he gets into Twitter beef with Oprah or whoever, and, you know, then it just exposes this whole other side of him that he maybe didn't intend to reveal.
Well, yeah, I think we need a return of that, like, 1960s activist pranksterism, you know, that the Yippies and people like Paul Krasner, Abby Hoffman sort of had when dealing with the powers that be, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've seen a real decline in kind of artist activism, you know, just because of how grotesque Trump is. It's hard to, like, write a song about him, or, you know, like, I don't know. It's so demoralizing that it's not, you know, like, sometimes it's just not funny because of how, like, gross this stuff is. So even when I've, you know, done stand-up comedy in the past, like, it's difficult now to even find what's funny about it, because it's just so over the top and so scary, I guess.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I think the creators of South Park said they can't do episodes on Trump because it's just too out there to even make fun of at this point. Like, it's too surreal to even joke about. Like, the comedy is that he's the president. How can you even top the reality of that in terms of comedy?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I would suggest, you know, more people kind of get in on doing just goofy stunts, you know, peacefully exposing him for the fraud that he is. And, you know, even the other night there was a protester, and he started yelling at one of his own people who was just pointing him out, and he says, you know, I got a huge weight problem, go home and start exercising. And it turned out that was one of his supporters that he made fun of.
You know, before you go, I wanted to ask you about some unrelated stuff. I want to ask first, you know, I know that you're a Bernie supporter. I think I even read that you have a Bernie tattoo. It's obviously, you obviously have sort of a resistance to authoritarianism. How did that sort of come about? What sort of pushed you in the direction of sort of giving the middle finger to authority, so to speak?
Well, I think I was raised, you know, in the post Watergate era. My parents were conservative Christians, so they wanted to kind of shield me from the larger world. So I was homeschooled, you know, for my entire life. So there was this thread of, like, we don't really trust the government, but yet we fully trust, you know, God and the church. And after a period of time, you know, I became more aware of things in the church that were a problem to me. And as I went to a Bible college, that kind of further opened my eyes to some of these problems. But at that point, in 2000, I voted for George Bush because he was the Christian candidate. So, you know, it took 9/11. It took the lies of Iraq, all of these things that kind of just did not make sense and did not jive with what I believed was like Christian, you know, moral behavior, going around and killing people based on a lie just didn't make sense. And so just deconstructing all of that kind of pushed me further to the left, I would say, in terms of politics. And yeah, finding somebody like Bernie with the message that, you know, cares about poor people, working people, and actual justice, as opposed to this rig system where people like Jeffrey Epstein get away with their crimes, are allowed to kill themselves or whatever happened in prison, and you know, other people are punished for yelling dad, you know. So
it's ass backwards in a way.
Yeah, I think a hard swing the opposite direction of Trump, because a lot of the reason he won was because he ran on Bernie's message, you know, a false populism that said he would look out for working people, said he would give them health care, yada, yada, yada. And it was all lies. So I'm back on board with Bernie. Just went down to Iowa last night where he was playing a game of softball with his staff and his kids on the actual Field of Dreams from the Kevin Costner movie. And it was just the most wholesome thing you could imagine. He's out there pitching and people are really hitting the ball. Like, he almost got nailed in the shin. it was fun to watch.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, ever since last week, we keep getting these, comparisons, you know, in the media, certain, sectors of the media saying, oh, Bernie criticized the Washington Post. He's doing the same thing as Trump, attacking the press. And I'm like, I don't know. I think Bernie Sanders comes from it from more like maybe a Noam Chomsky angle, whereas Trump comes at it from this, I don't know. He seems like one of those guys that would have been at a Nazi rally yelling, Lügenpresse, Lügenpresse. I think they're very different, ways of critiquing the media, and one is very dangerous, the other isn't.
Completely different. Completely. Yeah, I think there's valid criticism to be had of the media, and I think people tapped into that. There was a lot of things that Trump said that sounded good if you didn't look any further, and most people don't. You know, the surface level voter, the right versus left, red, blue kind of the divide does keep people in line and keep them voting for their team, and they don't really think much about it. And I think a character like Bernie does pull people from both sides who are sick of the bullshit, who, you know that the system isn't working for them. There's two different Americas, one for the rich and one for the poor. And so I think that message is going to go a long way, and we'll see where it ends up. But I definitely want to not only, you know, get Bernie on the record about what he would do as president to pursue the co-conspirators of Epstein. I think we should ask all of the presidential candidates to weigh in on what the heck we're going to do about this, because we need to get answers. We need to find the rest of the ring that's still out there and shut these guys down.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, some people have forgotten about the other players in this sordid saga of Epstein. I mean, he's not the only person. I mean, we still have Jean-Luc Brunel of MC2 Modeling, Les Wexner, although he claims he was duped by Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, of course. There's other people to look into. This doesn't just end with Epstein, and I think it has to be pursued further.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, you know, my goals are coming from, you know, the Epstein angle that I tapped into, and you know, the progressive movement. I think there's a way that they can kind of overlap, and because, yeah, this is an issue that does go across political aisles. You know, that's why people on the right respond, well, Clinton body count. That's why people pile in with Trump body count, but it's like, look at the larger, you know, systemic issues here that allowed someone like Jeffrey Epstein to flourish and to, you know, even get accepted back into how society, go to meetings with Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, you know, and hobnob with all of these Hollywood celebrities after spending time in jail, after being a registered sex offender. That to me is just beyond. And we need to deal with those people who gave him a pass and who co-conspired with him.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, I have some listeners that I thought would find it interesting, is before all this happens with you protesting Trump and the Epstein connection, I guess you were in Vice in an article about being a human guinea pig. Could you tell my listeners just a little bit about that and sort of what we mean by human guinea pig?
Yeah, this was a line that Fox News was happy to run with when they outed me as the man bun protester. It's actually a full-time human guinea pig and aspiring comedian. The human guinea pig thing is I just participated in medical research studies over the years because pharmaceutical companies want to pass, you know, new drugs onto the market or get generic drugs out there. So they go through a trial system, and, you know, that's its own little microcosm of the American healthcare system that is a little bizarre when you start to get to the inner workings of it. So Vice decided to talk to me about it and did that interview. Yeah, before any of this happened too, I also had a bizarre incident with squirt guns, a pedal pub, and a bunch of off-duty police officers. So if your listeners are curious about that, they can dig into that story as well.
Well, you know, I'm surprised that Fox News, well, I'm not surprised, but Fox News going after someone for, you know, being a medical test subject seems kind of weird. I mean, I know plenty of kids, you know, around my college and whatnot, that, and university that do that stuff to pick up some extra cash. I don't see a problem with it. I don't know how that discredits you in any way.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that was meant to discredit me, but it was very, I mean, bizarre and unsettling that they chose to do two separate articles about me, which only, you know, further shined the light on why I was protesting in the first place. So they really helped spread the Epstein narrative. And there was a number of other stories in the Daily Beast and Vox. And, you know, thanks to Trump and Fox News, you know, we were able to push the Epstein story to where it is now. And I'm not going to, you know, say that I had a hand in getting him in jail or where he ended up now. But, you know, sometimes I wonder.
Well, I appreciate your being humble about it. You're not being like Mike Cernovich, who is taking credit for all this now, even though he's buddy-buddy with Alan Dershowitz, who, you know, is way too close to Epstein for comfort.
Yeah, you should try to get Cernovich on your show and see what he has to say. I mean, these characters out there, it's just, it's very bizarre that they are playing with this fire that they know is going to burn them. I mean, it's not going to end well for Dershowitz, maybe even for Cernovich. So that just, it's bizarre to me to see how aggressively they've tried to push this and they're just pouring gasoline on a fire.
Before you go, because it just popped into my head, you mentioned doxing. Did you get a lot of harassment? What was it like when, you know, all your personal information sort of got out there? I mean, it must be a weird and unsettling experience.
It was. There was a few, you know, people who decided to send hate messages through Facebook and email or whatever. I think, you know, it popped up, obviously, on Reddit. It popped up on the Chans, I'm sure, because honestly, some people thought that that was like a cue related incident because nobody knew who I was. So obviously it must have been a paid protester. You know, Epstein was still a conspiracy theory at that point.
Wait, you mean they were trying to tie this into like QAnon and George Soros?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Oh yes. Yes. So it was a, you know, it was a bizarre mix of like people really being stoked about what I did versus people who are like, who's this man bun soy boy, you know, and a few messages. It hasn't gotten worse since then. I feel like, you know, there is common ground between, as bizarre as it is, I think there is common ground on both sides between the Epstein investigators. And I think if we are able to dig as far as we can and get all the answers, like, we'll both end up like high-fiving each other because we took down a bunch of corrupt rich people, you know. So hopefully that's a way to make America great again.
Or make America think again. I think we need more of that in this country. Make America funny again. Make America a lot of things again.
Seriously.
Well, I guess in closing, I like to end the show on a positive note and also give my guest a chance to plug anything they're working on, tell them how my listeners can follow them. Any positive vibes or anything else you want to throw out there about your work?
You can follow me on Twitter at Sam Spadino, and going to be pushing to kind of get my own show started up here soon, hopefully focusing on some of my areas of expertise, but also trying to make it funny, trying to make the activism take that to the next level. So follow me on Twitter. You'll see where it goes from here. I would say, you know, if you, a lot of people, I think, you know, are on board with the Epstein stuff, but then if they hear about Bernie, like that's a turnoff or something. And I would suggest, you know, get past whatever your bias is. Go watch the Joe Rogan podcast with Bernie and, you know, see what you think, you know, take an hour and just listen, you know, and then watch a Trump rally right after that and see the difference.
Yeah. And also, you know, never lose hope in taking these Trumpists and Trump and other, you know, rich fat cats down.
Yeah, absolutely. You see what the power of one person with a piece of paper inside of a Trump rally can do. And if we focus our intentions on bringing about justice for the victims of Epstein, getting rid of Trump, you know, if that's your goal, and moving America in a positive, kind, you know, loving direction, and maybe saving the planet while we're at it, I think little actions mean a lot. So to everybody who's listening, think about it. Figure out your way to get involved and then do a little something.
Well, hey, Sam Spadino, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this Parallax Views double feature. I hope you enjoyed my conversations with Project Censored's Mickey Huff and the man bun guy Trump protester, Sam Spadino. If you want, you can keep up to date with Sam on Twitter. Just use that search box, folks. Sam Spadino. And of course, I highly recommend checking out Project Censored at projectcensored.org. And you may want to pick up Mickey's new book, co-authored again with Nolan Higdon, The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. Available now from City Lights Books. It is a fantastic learning and teaching tool. If you enjoyed this episode of Parallax Views,
I'd like to remind you that you can support my work on Patreon. Any donation helps, folks. So keep that in mind. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.